How dare you defy our parliament? How dare you defy the Australian people? If you will not respect the people of Australia, you must not do business in this country. F*** off to North Korea.
Dr. Andy Schmulow, Australian legal academic consultant, political candidate renowned for his expertise in banking, financial regulation, corporate governance, and consumer protection.
There is only one question that interests me. Why does ASIC not enforce the law?
Why should a corporation have human rights? It's not a human being. And you know who else propagates this bullshit? Joe Longo, the head of ASIC, the head of our Securities and Investments Commission, wrote an article which I dug up.
Isn't it that government is blowing up asset prices through their policies and the rich are just investing in these assets?
Yes, and part of the reason for that is because...
If it continues the way that it's going, I don't think it's going to change.
I will never accept defeat. Okay. I will never, ever, ever accept defeat.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of the Unemployable Podcast. Today, we have a special guest that has flown all the way in from Sydney, literally rolling his luggage into the studio. Delayed on a flight, but you know what? He's still here. His name is Dr. Andy Schmulow. He's an Australian legal academic consultant, political candidate renowned for his expertise in banking, financial regulation, corporate governance, and consumer protection. Thank you so much for being here today.
My absolute pleasure.
Great to have you. He also serves as an associate professor of law at the University of Wollongong. And in the most recent election, he ran for the Australian Senate representing the New South Wales under the Australian Citizens Party as well. So tell us a little bit more about yourself, a little bit of a background, and then I want to get right into something that I listened to not long ago, earlier today, and it was an Instagram post where it got very, very heated, and I want to unpack that, and then we'll roll straight into it.
Well, thank you very much for having me, gentlemen, and I do apologize for being a little bit late. I grew up in South Africa, and that has colored my perceptions of the world very deeply. I come from a country that is incredibly beautiful and has the most incredible degree of potential and has been well and truly destroyed by corruption. And I came to Australia because I got scholarships and I came to do a PhD, and I chose Australia over the United Kingdom and the United States, where I also had offers of scholarship, because I thought, oh, well, be a lot like South Africa, similar climate. They also play rugby. I was wrong. I went to Melbourne and they play something else, which I don't even want to talk about.
We'll hold it against them.
A mate of mine nearly convinced me to become a Carlton supporter. Oh my God. They're the only team to have lost to North Melbourne. Anyway, let's not go there. It's too embarrassing. I fell in love with Australia. Not just because it is so physically beautiful, but because I think that Australians, when they're at their very best, are without doubt the best people in the world. And I've seen that. I've seen that in, you know, so many different places and so many different ways. Bushdoofs in Victoria, Aussies just having a laugh, playing silly buggers, being funny, but supporting each other, loving each other. And, you know, one of the things that had such a deep impression on me is, as a comparison, when they had those terrible floods, when Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans and thousands of Americans were sheltering in that huge stadium. I don't know how true this was, but there were reports that people were having to arm themselves and defend themselves at night from rape gangs. Right? In Australia, when they had floods in Queensland, what did people do? They put budgie smugglers and they put water wings on the statues, because that's what Australians are like. When the shit hits the fan, they're the best people in the world, and they look after each other and they stand by each other and they're unpretentious and they lend a hand. And I just looked at this and I thought, these people are special. And I'm not saying that to blow smoke up the asses of your listeners. I am a very straight talking person. If I thought Australians are rubbish, I'd be the first to say so. And I made a lot of friends in Australia, and I have very deep and enduring friendships with people in South Africa. But the friendships that I've made in Australia reflect the fact that I've had this blessing come into my life of Aussie mateship. There is nothing like it in the world. And I've got some fantastic friends in Sydney, and they lived in America for a long time. And I said to my mate Davo, are Americans capable of making true friendships? Is it in their psyche? And he said to me, he thought about it for a while, and he said, it's often transactional. Transactional. What? You're mates with someone because of something you can get out of them. Excuse me while I vomit in the corner. How disgusting. It's not the kind of mateship I get. I have a true blue Aussie mateship, and it's a blessing that's come into my life. And I feel deeply about this country, and I want to do something for this country. And I see storm clouds on the horizon. I see bad things on the horizon. I see changes in this country, changes that are too slow and too imperceptible to be noticed on a day-to-day basis, but that's how you boil a frog.
It was interesting. You said off air that you actually went to primary school with Elon Musk.
Yeah, he was a year below me.
Yeah. And what I find fascinating is time after time when we speak to people who have immigrated from other countries is that they're able to see the clouds on the horizon much sooner than the she'll be ripe Aussie.
Yep.
And yeah, maybe you can talk about that as well.
It's because we're sensitive to it. It's because we have it in the back of our minds. It's because I say to myself in the back of my mind, I am too old to move again. I've moved once because I saw storm clouds on the horizon, and I am too old to move again. And I'm running out of destinations where I can move to. The United States is a non-stop shitstorm. The place is tearing itself to pieces. People are tearing themselves to pieces. The fractures and the disagreements in that society are no longer polite and respectful.
But we're moving towards that here too, right? Like that.
I think Australians are a lot more tolerant towards one another when other people have different points of view.
Mm.
But I think what we are moving towards is what we have seen in the United States, the growth and the concentration of crony capitalism, of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and nobody being left in the middle. The United States used to have an enormous middle class. The United States used to be like Australia, basically a country of middle class. And there were a few people who were very wealthy, the Rockefellers and what have you. But the vast majority of Americans in the 50s and 60s, what's the American dream? Your own home, car in the garage, a chicken in the pot, right? That was the American dream, and the vast majority of Americans were reaching that dream. Today, people are falling out of the middle class in the United States faster than at any stage in America's history. And where are they going? A tiny percentage of them are becoming super wealthy, and the rest are becoming increasingly impoverished. And they're becoming increasingly impoverished despite the fact that they're holding down four jobs.
Why is this happening?
It's happening because democracy has been corrupted in the United States in the exact same way it's been corrupted in Australia. It's been corrupted by big corporations that buy off the major political parties. In the United States, they say that it costs $150,000 in donations, and you will get FaceTime with a congressman anytime you want it. $150,000 is less than a major corporation would spend in a year on fresh flowers for the executive floor, right? So for the amount that you're going to spend on fresh flowers, you can buy a member of parliament. And if you're willing to spend not $150,000, but $1.5 million, you own 10 congressmen. That's unbelievable, man. And in the aftermath of a very important case, Citizens United versus Federal Electoral Commission, they the Supreme Court put up a for sale sign outside Congress that said corporations will have the same human rights as a human being. Excuse me, there's a small problem with that argument. Corporations are not human beings. They are not living, breathing people. Why should a corporation have human rights? It's not a human being. And you know who else propagates this bullshit? Joe Longo, the head of ASIC, the head of our Securities and Investments Commission, wrote an article, which I dug up. He wrote an article in 1992 arguing for the exact same human rights to be awarded to Australian corporations, so that Qantas and Jetstar and Woolworths and Coles can march into Parliament and corrupt our politicians by buying them off. I know people and I work with people across the aisle in Parliament. I work with Liberals, I work with Labour, I work with Nationals, I work with Greens. There are good people in Parliament. But when the donors get into the caucus, they buy these fuckers off. And nobody can say no to them because the bigwigs in the party are going, don't upset the donors. If you upset the donors, we don't have enough money to fight the next election. Don't you understand? If we don't have money to fight the next election, we will lose. No money, no votes.
What? Why is this becoming a problem now, though? Because I don't imagine that this has just started occurring in the last couple of years. I imagine that this is the way the system has worked for a long time. So why is it becoming a problem now?
How you boil a frog. Why is it becoming a problem now? Because over a period of time, the consequences, the effects, the outcome of boiling the frog become worse and worse. The consequences, the effects, the outcome of buying politicians creates over time an increasing degree of market concentration. And as that increasing degree of market concentration takes hold, the effects of that market concentration become more observable. The effects on consumers become more observable, and the effects on the political process become more observable. So it becomes like a spiral that starts to turn tighter and tighter and tighter. So it starts on this very wide circle. And as this very wide circle starts to turn, you have lots of different competitors. You have Coles, you have Woolworths, you have Bilo, you have Franklin, you have 10 different supermarket chains in all sorts of places and in every single state and territory. And they're all donating money to politicians to get their way. And they're all getting a little bit more of their way and a little bit more of their way. And the circle starts to become tighter and tighter. And then as the circle starts to become tighter and tighter, Coles buys Safeway and Woolworths buys Safeway and Coles buys Bilo. And so they start to aggregate and concentrate and constrain. And then after 10 years, you turn around, you go, where'd all the fucking supermarkets go?
We talk about the boiling the frog and
the frog.
And something that we don't talk about it necessarily in that same way, but the thing that we're often coming back to is debt cycle, that the debt has just increased and continues to increase at a government level now. It used to be private was the problem. Now government debt is just going crazy. And the other thing is the K-shaped economy that you alluded to at the start, that the rich are getting richer. The poor are getting richer as well. But the divide between the rich and the poor is spreading at the fastest rate in a long time, right? Does that feed in, how does that dynamics feed into, you know, for the everyday person who is not keeping up with the billionaires?
There's a way in which
what's happening with relation to big corporations that's kind of affecting that.
There's a way in which we track that divide. It's called a Gini coefficient. And the Gini coefficient used to be negligible in Australia. In fact, in Australia, Australia was one of the most economically homogenous countries on earth. Everybody was middle class.
Yeah.
Not anymore. The rich are getting richer, and the rich are getting very rich very quickly. And they're doing it in all sorts of ways where they would have everybody believe that they're getting richer because they're so smart and they're so hardworking. Let me draw a big fat line under the word bullshit, right? That is absolute, unadulterated, indubitable bullshit. They are not getting richer because they're smarter and harder working. They're getting richer because they're gaming the system.
Well, isn't it that isn't it that government is blowing up asset prices through their policies and the rich are just investing in these assets, whether it be business, property, shares? Like, isn't that in simple terms what's happening?
Yes. And part of the reason for that is because John Howard took property prices out of the inflation calculation. It's one of the first things he did. He said to the Bureau of Statistics, you're not allowed to include property in how we calculate inflation.
Out of the basket.
Yeah.
Yep. If you'd put property in the basket, we would have had interest rate increases. We would have had more expensive money. We would have had dampening down of property prices. Now it's got to the point where there are something like $5 or $10 trillion worth of privately held property in this country. Now it's a runaway train we can't stop.
Yeah.
John Adams, who I speak to regularly, he's absolutely adamant we need a correction. We need a correction / 50% off property prices. Let's just have the correction and deal with it. I said to him, John, people will be slaughtering each other in the streets.
Yeah, yeah, because
it's crossed the Rubicon.
That can't happen.
So obviously you're, as you said in the start of the pod, you're straight talk with no bullshit. I'm assuming this is how you are in Parliament. How's that received when it said the frog's now starting to boil, if you will? There's people like Gerard Rennick, yourself, all starting to speak out in a fairly direct way. How does that impact you on a day-to-day basis in your chosen career path now?
I don't drop the F-bomb when I go to Parliament.
Well, mix it up a little.
Not because I respect the individual parliamentarians. As individuals, they may or may not be worthy of respect, but I have a level of respect that is deeper than I have words to articulate for what Parliament represents, which is that it is the democratically elected representatives of we the people. Mm-hmm. And if you will not respect we the people, then please take your business, PwC, and fuck off out of us, Australia, right? PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers, that went about engineering tax evasion, and when they got caught, they compiled a secret report which they were told to deliver to Parliament, and to this day they've refused to deliver it. I would fucking shut those bastards down. How dare you defy our Parliament? How dare you defy the Australian people? If you will not respect the people of Australia, you must not do business in this country. Fuck off to North Korea. How has it affected me in my daily life? PwC came after me. They sent their lawyers in. Their lawyers got hold of the university. The lawyers said, we want this guy sacked. We've got two PwC representatives on the council of the university, which is the highest decision-making body of the university. And they sent their lawyers from Allens after me. And the lawyers went to the university and they said, oh, he said all sorts of nasty things about the CEO. Oh, he's very nasty. Oh. So universities are risk averse and they well and truly shat themselves. So they called me and they went, oh my God, we've had lawyers' letters from Allens. They've said that apparently you said that the CEO of PwC, you called him resting bulldog face on LinkedIn. So I went, yeah, so. So they said, well, they've complained that it's a breach of the social media policy. I went, hold on. This was a Zoom meeting, so I was screen sharing. Let me just screen share for you for a moment. Here's where I got the phrase from, resting bulldog face. You'll see that it was used by a journalist by the name of Neil Chenoweth, who's won I don't know how many Walkley Awards, in a little-known publication called the Australian Financial Review. Here's where he called Kevin Burrows resting bulldog face. And you will see in my LinkedIn post, I put resting bulldog face between two little vertical lines called quotation marks. And then behind that, I said, Neil Chenoweth, Australian Financial Review. So the complaint is vexatious. So they said, oh, okay, but you said they're a cancer. So I said, yes, here's Hansard. Let me just screen share for you. Here's Hansard. Here's two members of the House of Representatives, both of whom are referring to PwC as a cancer. I went, oh, but you said they're a mafia. I went, yes. Here's a report from the House of Lords written in 2011 by the Lord Kingswood, Baron Prem Seeker, referring to PwC as the pinstriped mafia. And I went, oh, this went on for about 45 minutes.
Thank you for teaching us how to direct criticism.
Cover your ass when you
do. Yeah, have your bases covered, mate.
After about 45 minutes, they went, okay, we've heard enough. I went, no, I'm not finished. I said other things about them. Let me tell you what else I've said. I said this and I said this and I said this, and here's the evidence. So after they'd heard this for an hour and they were like just, you know, punch drunk after this, they went, oh, okay, the complaint is dismissed. I went, for you maybe, not for me. Contacted Parliament. I said, I'm a witness before a Senate inquiry. They've tried to interfere with me. They've tried to intimidate me. It's a criminal offence. I want them charged. I complained to Parliament. I complained to putting complaints to PwC's complaint resolution process, all of which is complete bullshit, obviously. I can't remember all the different places, and I had it spread across the media nationally and internationally. And at every stage, I made sure that I mentioned Kevin Burrows, resting bulldog face, right? This guy is a POM who's come to this country on a work visa. Now, I say this as an immigrant myself. You come to this country, you respect this country's laws. Otherwise, please pack your bags and I'll take you to the airport so you can fuck off. You come to this country, you respect this country's laws, right? You contribute to this country. You do not undermine it. That is the absolute single most essential component of your obligations to this country as an immigrant. He's come to this country on a work visa. He's running a criminal enterprise. PwC is a criminal enterprise. Every week there are new revelations about what PwC has done to break the law. In all of the corruption that's going on in New South Wales teaching, and the New South Wales Teaching Department and Education Department and their procurement, who's stuck in the middle of it? PwC. In the middle of every single procurement scandal that has affected federal or state government, who's in the middle of it? PwC. And when PwC had a secret report commissioned by a law firm called Linklaters, they had a secret report commissioned on who else in PwC around the world had conspired to act in Congress to attack the interests of His Australian Majesty the King. Who else in PwC, Singapore, New York, Los Angeles, London, Malaysia, had got together to extract secret tax information out of our treasury that had been given to PwC on a strictly confidential basis, to take that secret tax information and sell it to the biggest tax evading multinationals on earth so that they could continue to evade tax? Let me tell you where this problem began. It began with PwC showing multinationals how to evade tax, not avoid tax, which is legal. Not minimize tax, which is legal. I'm talking about evade tax. I'm talking about break the law, right? They showed them how to evade tax. And when the federal government realized what a problem it was and said, oh my God, what are we going to do about it? PwC stuck up their hands and said, we'll give you advice on how to fix the problem. Then in brackets, the problem we created. So the federal government said, oh, well, thanks for that. Geez, how will you help us solve the problem? They said, well, we'll tell you how we're going to do this. You're going to set up different entities for the federal government. One's going to be called the Tax Advisory Board, and the other one's going to be called the Board of Taxation. You, the federal government, you have to pay to establish those boards and you have to pay to run them. We will sit on those boards and give you advice at a cost of $140,000 a year each for 10 meetings a year. Let that sink into the minds of your viewers. You go to 10 meetings a year, you get $140,000, where we will then give the federal government advice on how to close these tax loopholes. But actually, what they found was they were giving the federal government advice on how to close the loopholes with other loopholes built in. And they were taking the other loopholes that they'd built in and running around North America in a project called Project North America to all of the tax evading multinationals that they hadn't yet snagged as clients, going, hey, you want to know how to evade tax in Australia? Come and be a client of ours and we'll show you the new loopholes. These guys are apex parasites. And we're paying for the opportunity and the privilege for them to financially rape us.
I'm assuming this is not the first time you voiced it with such passion. I think we should hashtag PwC in here for sure.
And have they been brought to justice for all these things that you're...
So the first thing that's happened is when the scandal broke, they were banned from doing any more consulting work for the federal government. Up until then, they were earning $600 million a year just from federal government consulting work, right? $600 million a year to do the most rubbish consulting work you can imagine. They got paid, listen to this, they got paid $1 million to produce an 8-slide PowerPoint presentation for RoboDebt, even though they knew RoboDebt was an illegal scheme. That's $125,000 per slide. What was on the slides that made them worth $125,000? The GPS coordinates for the location of Lucky, Lord Luke, and Amelia Earhart, and Elvis. So they produce this absolutely rubbish consulting work. KPMG produced for $18 million, advised the federal government on whether they should build a runway in Antarctica. I'll save you that $18 million in 20 seconds or less. Can the aircraft land on packed ice? Because if it can't land on packed ice, there's no point in building a runway, because 5 minutes after you've built it, it'll be covered in packed ice. So if the aircraft can't land on the runway with packed ice, there's no point in building the runway. If it can land on packed ice, you don't need to build a runway. You just landed on the packed ice. Bang, I just saved you $18 million. $18 million to KPMG to provide the exact same advice. It took them a year, and they turned around and they went, no, we don't think you should build a runway for $18 million. This is why we're paying so much tax. The big four consulting firms, PwC, Ernst & Young, KPMG, and Deloitte, have sucked down $21 billion in consulting fees in the last 10 years. This is why we're paying so much tax. People don't see the big patterns here. The patterns are that our federal government is being drained of money by private enterprise that is filling the ranks of civil servants who've been sacked so that Dutton and ScoMo can turn around and go, we're such a great prime minister, or Dutton said, I'll be such a great prime minister because I'll sack a third of the civil service. So who'll do the work?
So are we no different to like South America and all these countries, or what's the difference?
No, we are different. I tell you how we're different. It's a much more sophisticated form of corruption.
White collars.
We're just much better at the corruption. I have friends in South Africa who say to me, my God, South Africa is so corrupt. I say to them, so is Australia. It's just a better form of corruption. It's just a more sophisticated form of corruption. I'll give you an example. Do you remember John Barilaro, the deputy premier of New South Wales, who had that nonstop run-in with friendly Geordies?
No.
John Barilaro, who is functionally illiterate, set up a selection committee for New South Wales to appoint a trade representative in New York on $500,000 a year. And guess who the selection committee chose to be the $500,000 a year trade representative in New York? John Barilaro, right? This is how we do things in Australia. You set up a committee so it looks legitimate, tax practitioners board, tax advisory board, whatever. You set up some kind of a structure so that it looks legitimate, and then you just dish it out to your mates.
So we've sort of, probably move on a little bit, but just so that's the exposure of the corruption of the big four gouging the taxpayer. What's your immediate solution, and are you making an impact?
Well, I've obviously made enough of an impact that I've really pissed off Kevin Burrows, and I'm very proud of that.
Okay.
And I've gone before the Senate inquiry, and I've gone before the Parliamentary Joint Inquiry into what to do about PwC, and in both of those inquiries adopted my recommendations virtually in their entirety. It was virtually a copy and paste from my submission, and they put it in their final report. Now, has the final report been adopted by the government? No. Why? Because guess how much money the big four donate to both political parties? They donate the same amount to both political parties. So they have a
hedge.
It's called hedging your bets.
Yeah, it's a bet each way. Yeah. It's unbelievable, man.
Yeah.
So the Liberal Party and the Labor Party are too shit scared to take on the big four accounting firms because they're both getting about $20 million a year in donations, and they can't fight an election without that, which is not as much as they're getting from the big four banks. And the big four banks, Commonwealth, Westpac, NAB, ANZ, are the most profitable banks in the world by return on equity. How do you achieve the most profitable banks in the world in a country with a population the size of Australia?
How do you think?
By gouging. by gouging people, by squeezing and squeezing and squeezing and squeezing. In the United States, you can get a mortgage. It's routine. You get a mortgage at a fixed interest rate for the entirety of the loan. We don't have anything like that here. In the United States, banks have to take on interest rate risk, not here. In Australia, the banks take on no risk. If you default, there's no risk because they get the house. And if interest rates go up, there's no risk because they're not tied to a fixed interest rate. And when interest rates go up, have you noticed how our banks put interest rates up the same day? But when interest rates go down, all of a sudden it's too high, it's too difficult. It takes them a month to put the interest rates down. Why? It's the same computer system that can put interest rates up immediately, can take interest rates down immediately. And what's the interest rate differential worth to them by not putting it down for a month? It's billions and billions of dollars.
What are the, you mentioned earlier storm clouds. Right now,
these weren't enough for you.
Well, what? I mean, what are some storm clouds that the everyday person, like, okay, the banks, yes, understand, but is there anything else that people aren't seeing? Right, we have friends, we've got personal friends, right, that are leaving the country. Mm. Now, when I came here 18 years ago, I didn't know anybody leaving the country, right. Because they wanted to leave the country.
Mm.
People are now leaving the country. People are you know, upset. Like you said, Australians, when they are at their very best, are the best people in the world.
Mm.
And I'm starting to see a lot of Australians not being at their best. What other storm clouds are out there that you think are coming or are already here, but they're in disguise?
So let me take a step back so that I can more fully agree with what you've just said. In 2022, I was asked to provide advice to the European Parliament on the revolving door, and I did work with an Italian member of the European Parliament, Sabrina Pignodoli, who looks like a young Gina Lollobrigida, and I worked with her staff, all Italian. Most fantastic people I've ever worked with. Magnificent, right? And I spent a little bit of time traveling around Italy. And it pains me to say this because I don't live in Italy, but it is hands down the most beautiful country in the world. It is just ridiculously beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
It is staggeringly beautiful. It is absurdly beautiful, from the Dolomites to the Mediterranean, and the history and the creativity. I mean, the creative capacity that comes out of Italy is unbelievable. And it's not just fashion and Ferraris. It's aerospace, it's engineering, it's architecture, it's modern design. I mean, Italy is just this volcano of creativity, right? And I was speaking to all of these Italians in Sabrina Pignedoli's office, and they were all like, yep, we live in Belgium now. There's no ways we all go back to living in Italy. I was like, why? Why wouldn't you want to live in Italy? No future.
That's what they all say.
Nothing works.
I was like, what do you mean there's no future? He's like, so corrupt. So corrupt, there's no future for us. I was like, are you for real? You'll never live in Italy again. I thought, my God, I thought it was like South Africa that's like that. But Italy, like, it's a G8 economy, for God's sake. No, we don't want to live in Italy. There's no future for us. I gave a guest lecture at the University of Rome. They flew me to Rome and they flew me back to Brussels and they put me up in a hotel for two nights and paid for my Uber and they owed me about $600. It took me a year and a half to get the $600. The amount of attestations that I had to sign, the amount of documents that I had to sign, the amount of sworn testimonies that I had to sign, that I'm not related to anybody at the university, that I'm not bribing anybody, the red tape to try and combat corruption. It took 18 months to get the payment and it doesn't work because the country's so corrupt, right? So I absolutely understand what you're saying. And if we're getting to the point where this has become a country where people only want to come here, to becoming a country where people who come from absolute shitholes want to come here, but people who are here already want to leave, that's a very bad state of affairs. And let me tell you what I think some of the storm clouds are. We have got to get money out of politics, right? Politics is about the duly elected representatives of we the people, not the duly elected representatives of Qantas, of Woolworths, of Commonwealth Bank, of Rio Tinto, of PwC. We the people. The moment you lose sight of that, you lose democracy. And we have seen how these companies have consistently gone about corrupting the political process. The Qantas Chairman's Lounge. The Qantas Chairman's Lounge is a fabled example of political corruption. That politicians are crawling over their own mother to get access to the Qantas Chairman's Lounge. That Alan Joyce was commanding political appointees because he was giving them access to the Qantas Chairman's Lounge. And then we hear that Anthony Albanese has arranged for his 18-year-old little snot son to get access to the Qantas Chairman's Lounge, and then the fucker has the audacity to turn around and say, don't talk about my family. Well, I've got news for you, Mr. Albanese. The Qantas Chairman's Lounge is supposed to be for captains of industry to reward them for sending millions of dollars of travel to Qantas every year. What has your son done? If your son isn't sending millions of dollars of travel to Qantas, what is he doing in that lounge? And I'll tell you what he's doing in that lounge. He's being your son. The Prime Minister, it's corruption. There is no other explanation. And the fact that you let him do that marks you as a man who is not fit to be Prime Minister. You should have said to your son, there is no ways I will allow you to be a member of the Qantas Chairman's Lounge because it's Alan Joyce's way of getting in my ear. So what have we got? We've got increasing market concentration. Qantas Jetstar owns 70% of the market. We've got Woolworths and Coles that own 70% of the market. We've got four banks that our Productivity Commission said are a cozy four-bank oligopoly. And while all of this shit is going on, we've got the media, particularly the Murdoch media, that is distracting people with culture wars. Let me give you an example. We've got people winding other people up about what pronouns people use. Now, I want to ask you something. Whether I call myself he, him, or they, them, or it, yo, what difference is it going to make to how much money you pay for a loaf of bread at Woolworths? Riddle me that. Is it going to make any difference to how much you pay? So what happens is we're getting the media winding people up about culture wars so that they will chase their tails, so that they will fight with each other where there's no resolution, so that they will joust at windmills, so that they will shadow box and try and capture the wind, which is a completely pointless exercise, and in the process distract them and take away their productive capacity to fight where the problem is. Market concentration, Coles and Woolworths. Why? How do we fix the problem of excessive market concentration in the grocery market? It's not rocket surgery. The answer is more competition. So how do we stop people from getting to that obvious solution? What do we do about the lack of competition in our supermarket industry? Oh, I don't know, more competition. No. We don't want people saying that. Because if we have people saying what we need is more competition, then what we might get is more competition. We don't want that. Because the moment we have more competition, then Coles and Woolworths will no longer be, listen to this, right, the most profitable supermarket chains in the world. Let me just let that sink in. Coles and Woolworths bitch and whinge and moan and complain, oh, your job's so hard, we only make 1.5%. Yeah, but you make 1.5% off billions of dollars of sales. And your return on equity in the case of Coles is 33%. Do you know what the return on equity is? The average return on equity for supermarkets in the United States? 1.4%.
Is it true, though, for every dollar that Coles and Safeway make, the government collect five? That's what we had Topher Field on the show, and he said that for every dollar that the Coles and Woolworths supermarkets collect, the government collect five in some form of taxation.
Well, I'd need to see the evidence. I can't say.
You don't know to be the case.
No, I don't know that to be the case. But what I can tell you is there are 14 major supermarket chains in the United States. Right? 14. The average, please forgive me, like I put all of this in my submission to the supermarket inquiry. If I've got some of the figures wrong between the United States and Europe, please forgive me, but it's all in my submission to the supermarket inquiry. As I recall, there are 14 major supermarket chains in the United States with an average return on equity of 1.4%. Coles, 33%. Where do you think that money's coming from? It's coming from the fact that they are charging such high prices. How do we get Coles and Woolworths to bring that down their prices? This is not rocket surgery. How do you get any business to bring down its prices? More competition. So why are we not having a discussion in this country about more competition? Why is Anthony Albanese saying anything except we need more competition? He's saying we need another inquiry. We need a task force. We need price transparency. Fuck all of that, man. What we need is another two major supermarkets. So why are we not talking about that? Because Coles and Woolworths are big party political donors. Nobody will touch them as long as they are big party political donors.
Is it viable for competition though? These guys have soaked up all the rest of them. It's fairly, it'd be fairly, you know, a fearful act for somebody to go and put some more competition in the marketplace, knowing that they're going to get swallowed up by these guys regardless.
I'll tell you how you do it. Number one, you provide the ACCC with a proper anti-monopoly power. They've had that in the United States since 1911, right? So 114 years. We are 114 years behind the United States. Number one, you provide the ACCC with the ability to block a merger and acquisition. Number two, you implement a divestiture power. So you say to Coles and you say to Woolworths, you have 6 months to do the following. You will identify the top third grossing stores by square meterage, the middle grossing stores by square meterage, the bottom grossing stores by square meterage, one third in each category. You will then hive those off into a separate company and you have 6 months to sell that. If you don't sell it in 6 months, we're just taking it away from you. So sell, baby, sell. You then find buyers for those two packets of one third from Coles and one third from Woolworths, and voila, 6 months' time, instead of two major supermarkets, you've got four. Problem solved.
So how does Aldi stack into this then? Like they're not as prevalent as your Coles and your Woolworths, but they're having an impact, are they or not?
They are, according to the Productivity Commission, the Productivity Commission took Coles, Woolworths and Aldi and said they are now, those three are now the most profitable supermarket chains in the world.
We got Costco coming, huh?
Yeah, but how many, is there a Costco on every street corner?
Not every street corner, no. But they've taken a lot of market share in North America, but I think it takes
time. In North America?
Yeah, but I think it takes time for Australians to adapt. We're very obedient to, you know, and very accustomed to
Starbucks
too. Like you're either a Woolies shopper or you're a Coles shopper.
Yeah, and like, it's gonna take a long time for Costco to break into that market because Coles and Woolworths have been land banking.
Well, imagine, like if you have a Woolies, like you're either a Woolies or a Coles, right? It's hard enough going from Woolies and going, oh, it's not at Woolies. I want to go to Coles. Nah, I won't go to Coles. I'll just wait till tomorrow and go back to Woolies.
Right. And then you go to
the mentality of
And then you go to Aldi and it's just shit anyway.
Well, they've tried different low-cost airlines that ultimately haven't worked. Why don't they work? Is it because the consumer just chooses?
Because why doesn't it work? South Africa. Okay, South Africa's got a population of about 55 million people, but the amount of people in South Africa who have enough disposable income to fly would be less than the traveling public in Australia. Seven airlines. And you know why we only have two? It's not because it's so difficult to break into the market. It's because Qantas does something similar to land banking. I can't remember what the term is. They bank boarding slots. They bank plane parking slots, right? And they won't share those parking slots to any other airline, and they don't use them all.
They've got them on contract or something.
Yep, and they don't use them all. So they've got 50 parking slots, and they use 30, and they won't let anybody else use the other 20, because if the other 20 were made available, oh, we might have another airline. Mm. Oh, we can't have that. Better speak to Mr. Albanese and remind him, Albo, remember what we did for you? We gave your little 18-year-old snot son access to the chairman's lounge.
Is and same with banking, similar sort of rhetoric. You've got the 100%. Top four. I mean, you've got all these spin-offs like Me Bank, you've got Bendigo Bank, Queen, like you've got all these other spin-offs.
But uncompetitive. Why? Because we have a thing called an IRBM, internal rating-based model, which allows banks to determine if you're a big bank, you get to build your own model to determine how much capital you need to hold in reserve, depending on the riskiness of the loans you've made. So if you think about it this way, the amount of capital you have to hold in reserve is like a tax, right? Because every dollar in reserve capital that you hold is a lazy dollar on your balance sheet. It's a dollar you can't lend. So when you say to a big bank, you have to hold a certain amount of capital in reserve, depending on whether the loan is tier one, tier two, or tier three. And if it's tier one, it's a better quality loan. It's a better quality asset. A loan is an asset on a bank's books. It's a better quality loan, so you hold a lower amount of capital. But you're a big bank, so we think you know everything, and we think that you're masters of the universe. So you determine, under the IRBM model, you determine which loan should be category one, two, or three. Guess which category they put everything in? You won't believe it. Category one. They game the system. I said at the beginning, the game is rigged. Small banks, credit unions, they don't get to use an IRBM. They get a loan quality matrix imposed on them by the bank regulator, and they're not allowed to stray out of it, which means right there, running the bank is more expensive. Secondly, the bigger the bank, the bigger the taxpayer guarantee. Fucking taxpayers guaranteeing these banks. So the bigger the taxpayer guarantee, the more assured those banks are of being able to repay the loans they take from other banks, which means they pay a lower interest rate. So their funding costs are lower. The Reserve Bank estimates that the saving on the funding costs of our four major banks comes to $2.7 billion a year, thanks to the taxpayer guarantee. So I said to the bank closure inquiry, which had a bank closure inquiry last year and another one 20 years ago, and the one 20 years ago, all the bank executives fronted up and said, we promise we will shut no more branches. And they were shutting branches while they were making the promises, and have done nothing but shut branches for the last 20 years. I said to the bank branch closure inquiry, the taxpayer guarantee has saved these bastards $74 billion over the last 20 years. And we're not allowed to turn around and go, you will fucking provide a bank branch in the bush, for God's sake. What's going on, man? And the answer is, what's going on is we don't have politicians who will stand up to the banks. Why? Because they're getting big party political donations. Who was running the branch closure inquiry last year? Who hammered the banks last year? Matt Canavan. What party is Matt Canavan from? The Nationals. Good on Matt Canavan. But I've got a question for Senator Canavan. What the fuck were you doing in government for the last 10 years? You had 10 years, you bastard. You had 10 years to say to the banks, you will shut no more branches. And what did you do? You sat there with your thumb up your ass going, sorry, I'm busy. I'm in the Qantas Chairman's Lounge. The fuck, man?
What are your...
Eric, you've got access to the Chairman's Lounge, don't you?
No, honestly, I got my own Chairman's Lounge.
I want to come back to the distraction. Peter Dutton had a big fat sook, and he started winding people up about the fact that when Anthony Albanese gives a press conference, he stands in front of an Australian flag and an Aboriginal flag and a Torres Strait Islander flag. And Peter Dutton made a big show and a big song and dance about, you're a Prime Minister, I stand in front of an Australian flag and we more flag. My question is this, Mr. Dutton, whether you stand in front of an Australian flag or an Aboriginal flag or a fucking Federation of Planets Star Trek flag, what difference will it make to the cost we pay for bread and milk at the supermarket? None. So why are we talking about flags? We're talking about flags to distract people. We're talking about flags so that people will get hung up about what pronouns people use. What the fuck difference does it make to the price you're going to pay for anything, whether I call myself him, her, it, they, or yo, you?
That's their strategy, flags and fags, huh? That's not the diversion strategy.
And you know what else? You know what else? Guess who's fueling this? Right? Guess who's fueling this? Let me just point out to you, we say that there's a supermarket duopoly because it's Coles and Woolworths. But look at the ownership. BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard own both. It's not even a duopoly. It's a monopoly.
Yeah, and for people who don't understand what he means by that, if you look at all the funds that hold the shares of Coles and Woolworths, the biggest shareholders are those funds.
Yep. Yep. So you've got, so the bigger shareholders of Coles,
whether they're
Woolworths,
on behalf of their clientele or whatever, it's them, those funds.
Well,
them
BlackRock is a hedge fund. BlackRock is a hedge fund. Like Larry, whatever his name is, he owns the fund, right?
It's that time of year again at Unemployable where we're opening up our Unemployable business coaching program. It's over a 12-month period. And with that, you get private one-on-one coaching, group coaching, as well as private and live events throughout the year. You can get private coaching with me, and not only me, but our panel of experts that we have put together. These panel of experts have been in our network and are the exact people that we use in our business successes. People from branding, sales, marketing, our lawyers, our accountants, everyone that has helped build our businesses, you have access to. If this sounds of interest, go to www.unemployable.com.au/coaching and register your interest to see if it's a fit for you and us. Hope to see you there.
The people who own the people in charge of BlackRock own the fund. They're not investing on behalf of...
They are, aren't they? They have assets under management? No?
They have some assets, but most of it is their own fund. That's why he's one of the richest men in the world. The people who own Coles and Woolworths are the same people. It's the same company. And the only reason why they haven't made them one brand is because they've said to themselves, if we end up with one supermarket, then we will have a cries out for competition. So leave it at two. We'll make it look like we have competition. And then every now and then, come Australia Day, we have Woolworths going, oh, we're not going to stock Australia Day merchandise. What's that designed to do? Yeah. Wind people up. And, oh, we're going to boycott Woolworths because they're not supporting Australia Day. We're only going to go to Coles. Good, go to Coles. It's the same company. And then when that whole thing's died down, and when Woolworths has said, we're so sorry, we shouldn't have done this, and we back down. Have you noticed how somebody's doing this every single year? Mm-hmm. So every single year, it's like flash, Australia Day, he, him, they, them. Which flags are you standing in front of? So that people are not turning around and going, I'm not interested in any of that shit. What I'm interested in is, why do we only have two supermarkets?
Well, people are slowly starting to wake up to the diversion tactics with identity politics here in Australia. Wow. Like you said, we're always about 114 years behind America.
But right? I think they have no choice because, again, the cost of living is really starting to impact people now, right? Whereas before, they could still go out to eat. They could still maybe go on a trip. They could go maybe buy a new car. A lot of people are struggling now.
Long way to go.
Right? And like what you're saying, the storm
clouds. You can squeeze them a lot harder.
Right? The storm clouds.
I say it all the time. We haven't felt enough pain yet here.
Yeah. And that's the thing.
How many Australians are working two or three jobs?
Oh, multiple. I know multiple people that are working and Ubering at night and then Ubering on the weekend. And they're like,
how many Australians are working and living in their car?
Yeah. Yeah.
We got a lot to squeeze.
Yeah.
They've squeezed Americans to the point where your average Walton store employee gets paid a starvation wage and has to feed themselves using food stamps.
Yeah.
And they live in their car.
Yeah. So you can't die of starvation in this country. Yeah.
So just paint the picture, just in case people aren't super clear on it. Again, that analogy of boiling the frog in the pot slowly. But as we'll said here, is that there's a long ways to go. When we hit that point of go, the end road, what does it look like?
Well, I'll tell you what it looks like in America.
No, I mean, that's America. If we're not like America, like in Australia, what
America has guns.
Yeah. In America, people get guns and they start killing each other. There were not gun massacres in America in the 50s and 60s. Or if there were, they were vanishingly rare. Now it's an average of more than one a day. What they're going to start doing in this country is they're going to start bashing each other. They're going to start taking bits of wood and baseball bats and bashing each other because they are so angry, they're so frustrated, they're so desperate, they're so hopeless.
We see it online with the kind of feedback that we get.
Oh, the comments.
And the comments that we get.
The comments is what gives us the feedback. And that's when I know, right, who do we bring on, who we don't bring on. We have a whole team around us now that does that. And the comments basically let us know, right? And there's so much hatred, there's so much anger.
True.
Right? And then you hear things like last week, or it was this week, I think, that somewhere in the U.S., a guy started a bushfire on purpose, right, for the firefighters to come, and he's snipering him while he's in the bush. Bang, bang, bang. Like, you look at that and you go, How angry is that guy? You look at the guy that killed that other executive in the US, right? And wrote on the bullet, whatever it was, and killed him because it was one of his relatives didn't get the required healthcare and got shafted by the system. And then, you know, I don't know the exact story, but like, think about the anger that you would have to go and risk your entire life now to do something like that. And I'm with you, Andy, that I think there's still a lot to squeeze. I do see people living out of their cars, right? But we don't see 10 cities here, you know.
No.
Like you, it's very difficult.
But I'm starting to see a lot of homeless people in Sydney.
Yeah, but what you mentioned earlier about Italy is so true. And Italy is one of my favorite countries. That they've been blessed with beauty, 110%. And I was at a gelato place a couple of weeks ago, and it's an Italian gelato place here on the Gold Coast, and majority of them are Italians that work there that are on working holiday visas. And there was this lady, this young girl, probably in her, I don't know, early mid-20s. And we got talking to her. And she's like, oh, I love this country so much. There's so much opportunity here. And I'm like, why did you come? She goes, same thing, no opportunity in Italy. I go, so explain to me, what do you mean? She goes, I'll explain to you. I was working 40 hours a week, earning €1,200 a month.
My God.
She goes, I come here, it's like winning the lottery for me right now, right? And this is what I mean. There's still lots of pain to come because she'll probably be working at a gelato shop, getting paid $25 to $30 an hour, right? She's 21, she's 22, 23. She's probably got three roommates. Mm. You could still make ends meet. There's going to be a point in time where then she has kids, she wants to get ahead, she's got a mortgage, she wants to get married, she wants a car in the driveway, right? And the chook in the pot, like you said earlier, and there's going to be a point in time where it's like, you know what, there's no chook in the pot and there's no car in the driveway.
And there's definitely no mortgage because you'll never afford to buy property.
And, that's another thing I want to tap into.
But we give oxygen to these debates in this format, which I think is essential for us to move forward and through it. And so many people, like I just got told to, if I don't like it, pack up and leave in the comments. And it's like,
you don't like what?
Well, whatever topic we were talking about, we were talking about inflation.
Right? Inflation.
Yeah, we're saying how the biggest inflation is actually tax. Like taxes have gone up more than the cost of bread. If you really want to have a look at it and have that discussion, you know, a 400 square meter block of land back in 2008 cost $120,000. Today, the government makes more than $120,000 on that same block of land.
Just in the sale price.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So the biggest inflation is tax, right? And people are saying, oh, you know, we live in the lucky country. If you don't like it, piss off. It's not that we're saying that Australia is worse off than other countries. We, relatively speaking, are still very lucky in this country. Well, I think what we're all here fighting for or speaking for is that
is to preserve what
we've
got.
Let's preserve it before it's too late.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, preserve it. But the issue is now is there's great divide happening. Like what you said earlier, it was all middle class at one point. So I am you, you are me. It's not the case anymore.
No.
So when people in the comments see us talking about it and I go, well, if there's an issue, my thing is make more money. That's my excuse. Mm. Think outside the box, create business, you know, look for deals. Like that's my motto. Like, or you're going to sit there and complain. Like there's one or the other, right? Or you're going to pack up and leave and go somewhere else if you're not happy, right? It wasn't like that before. So now we're dealing with these issues going, like moving forward, I'm continuing to buy more properties. Why? Because people will say, oh, because you bought properties, you know, 18 years ago and you got lucky and you got all this uplift and all this. But the reality is, more property will be held in less hands.
100%.
Right? Mm. So there's going to be a lot more people with zero property, and there's going to be a lot of other property owners going, how many, like we have people that are around us. We interviewed a guy not long ago. He's got 300 properties. This guy's got 20 properties. This guy's got 8 properties. Like 20 years ago, that was unheard of. Nobody owned fucking 20 properties 20, 30, 40 years ago. What they owned was a house with a bit of a white picket fence with a chook in the pot. That is starting to fade now. And this is where, in my opinion, when we see these comments, there's this divide. And the divide is what you said earlier, in my opinion.
The gap.
That, yes, the gap, right? But you said something interesting. You said rich are getting richer, but the poor are still getting richer too. What do you mean by that?
I don't think they are.
Well, the standard of living for the poor is better today than what it was 30 years ago.
Yes, but that's because
and the poor, like even in America, the poor's wages have increased. But the problem is, and it's like, if you know, there's that survey where you ask a bunch of people, they asked a bunch of people, you know, would you want to be Rockefeller or would you want to be you? And everyone said, we want to be Rockefeller. And then they went back and they said, well, this is how Rockefeller lived. He didn't have a fridge. He didn't have electricity. He didn't have this, didn't have that. Would you still want to be Rockefeller? And 99% of people changed their mind and said, no, I'd rather be me today. Right. So relatively speaking, capitalism, while it isn't perfect, is probably the best system that we've got. Not crony capitalism, but capitalism is probably the best system we've got to do good in the world. You know, like other than love, capitalism is probably the second best thing in order to lift people out of poverty and to do good in the world. But the problem is that we're getting to that point where the Gini coefficient is expanding and the rich are getting way too rich, that you've got a mayor in America now that's just been elected, socialist mayor, self-proclaimed socialist mayor, saying, we shouldn't have billionaires. There's no need to have billionaires in the world. Now, whether that's true or not, whether you should or you shouldn't, the reality is we're getting to the point where it's like pitchforks against the billionaires. Mm. And that is continuing the divide, and it's not bringing us to a good place.
Let me say a couple of things. You are absolutely right that the modcons with which we live have increased out of sight. So for example—
Unless you're in a tent city. And then there's zero, and that's in America. And you're saying that's coming here as well. So,
well, I'm starting to see that in Sydney. Hmm. But a very poor person today would have more modcons and—
What's a modcon, just for people that don't know?
Appliances.
Yeah.
Would have more and better appliances today than a king would have had in medieval times, 100%. But they are also saying that I can never remember which one it is. Is it Z, Generation Z, the youngsters?
No.
I've got to that age where I refer to them as millennials.
I don't know anyone after millennials.
There's so many, but are you the age of 20 to 30?
Yeah, thereabouts. Yeah. Is the first generation that will be, in absolute and relative terms, poorer than their parents. So for 150 years, generation by generation, the standard of living has gone up. And for those, am I visible? For the first time, we're going to see that do this. That's what they're saying. That's the first thing. The second thing I want to say is I absolutely agree with you 100%. Capitalism is the best and the most efficient system. But capitalism requires competition. Mm. It is absolutely 100% inherent to the doctrine of capitalism. Competition
and it requires creative destruction. Like in 2008 and in 2020, when the Fed started bailing out corporates by buying corporate bonds, that creative destruction wasn't allowed to happen anymore.
Yeah. Yep.
And so you need businesses to fail in order for capitalism to flourish. And when it doesn't, when you're basically supporting businesses, you're pretty much playing. It's pretty much communism with capitalism characteristics, like China.
Yep. And Alan Fells, who was the inaugural chair of the ACCC, he's a man I admire enormously. He's incredibly smart, and he has battled the biggest corporations in this country to make sure that we have more competition. Him and his successors, including Rod Sims, have said business doesn't tend towards competition. They tend towards monopolies. They don't worry about what they tell you. They don't like competition, and they will buy out their competitors to remove competition. And if you allow them to do that, eventually any industry will end up as a monopoly.
Well,
it's the law of it's like the law of the jungle, right? The strongest will survive.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, again, I look at it at two sides, right? Because I look at it from an entrepreneur point of view, right? And I'm in business, and we have multiple businesses in different industries, and you know, I say at times competition is good, but at times, right, when I put on my entrepreneur hat, I'm not as an entrepreneur, right? You're at times you look at things skewed. Not all the time are you looking at things going, I want all things being equal and abundant. At times you're going, I want to buy that guy out. he's a pain in my ass and I want to buy that company out as an example, right?
Or crush him,
right? And it's a competition to the top, in right? It's like you, right? Who are you trying to chase in your business? I know that, right? You compare yourself to a company, right? You'd compare yourself to a company. I'd compare myself to a company, and you're always striving to take what? Market share, to the point where, you know, it could be damaging to the people, right? But it's not so damaging to the business owner because of, again, once you put that entrepreneurial business owner mindset, right? At the end of the day, you're looking at a P&L going, looking at percentages.
I'm not here to talk. I'm not here to argue. I'm not a lobbyist.
Yes.
For business owners.
Yeah.
I'm a lobbyist for Joe Public.
Yeah, correct. No, I understand that, right? But this is where, right? And I've said this before, right? On a pod and post recently, going, the issue right now in this country, I feel a lot as well, is you've got the employers and the employees, and that gap of respect, that gap of that relationship, right, is diminishing. Yeah, more heavily now than others. Like right now,
but isn't 30% of Joe Public employed by small business owners as well?
Mm.
Right. So this is the thing that I'm like what you're saying, and this is the thing that I'm battling with, especially in the last couple of weeks when hearing people attack corporate profits. I think we need on our podcast, we have a duty of care to start differentiating between self-employed and small business owners.
Yeah.
And large corporations, because I don't think you can consider them in the same basket.
100%.
No, I agree.
But, right, and I think, yeah.
But you look at the compliance, right? Like if you're a small business, I think is anywhere from 9 to 19 employees. I think that's what I read. Like if you have anywhere from 9 to 19 employees, the compliance to manage those employees, like we talked about these companies like Employsure and these types of things, the amount of money it takes to make sure that, like, it's not like, all right, Andy, you want to start tomorrow? Great. Here's a handshake. You're on $30 an hour plus double time on weekends.
You've got to
forget about
RH&S.
Right? Oh, yep. Man. It's an extravaganza, right? For the protection, right, of the employee and the protection of the employer. But the issue is the relationship, I think, in my opinion, and I see it from the comments. I didn't know this too much before because I'm in businesses where we create culture and there's camaraderie and, you know, people are, and there's always going to be difficulties in business. Don't get me wrong. And some businesses are going to be different than others. But then I see some of the comments and I'm just like, man, people are angry. They hate their owner of the business. They hate them, right? Like I know people that will drive a Toyota to work and they have a Lamborghini in the garage. Like because they don't want people working for them to think that they're earning too much money because then the people are going to ask for like that whole mentality to me is crazy. What are your thoughts on that? Like, what are your thoughts on the employee and the employer? Because at the end of the day, whichever side you're on, I need you just as much as you need me, but we're not respecting that.
I think maybe some of that is projection. Mm-hmm. And I think that some of that projection is coming from, is being, perhaps being directed at individuals because of a general perception that the game is rigged. And it is that sense that the game is rigged that is starting to piss people off. And the reason why they're getting pissed off and the reason why they have this perception that the game is rigged is because the game is rigged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The biggest corporations in this country pay no tax. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, X, or whatever Elon Musk is brain farting calling it this week, pay no tax. News Corp, which owns 75% of legacy media in this country, pays no tax. Rio Tinto, which mines billions of dollars in this country and sets themselves up offshore, pay no tax. The wealthiest families in this country pay no tax. And I think that when ordinary Australians are struggling, and maybe they see the owner rocking up in a Lamborghini and they're struggling because they're paying so much tax. The way you remove that is not what the government is doing. And what the government is doing is raising the minimum wage. So I've got a mate who runs a small business and he's saying to me, I can't afford the new minimum wage, mate. Mm. I can't afford to employ someone at whatever it is now, to how many dollars an hour. I can't employ them, which means I have to do all of their work, which means I don't get home until midnight every night. And I have to work every weekend because I can't pay the minimum wage. And the government's trying to solve the problem of a cost of living crisis by increasing the minimum wage instead of fixing the problem where it lies. And where does the problem lie? The two biggest costs that we're paying are groceries and accommodation. Groceries are costing so much because we have the most profitable supermarkets in the world. We have the most profitable supermarkets in the world because they have no competition. Mortgages and the knock-on effects of the price of mortgages, the rent you pay, are so expensive because we have the most profitable banks in the world because they have no competition, because they've bought up all the other banks while APRA, the bank regulator, has sat with its thumb up its ass. And ASIC, the securities regulator, has sat with its thumb up its ass going, hang on, Andy Schmulo gave financial advice. We better go after him because he expressed a comment on a chat group.
But accommodation is one of those things as well. Like, you look at accommodation and you come to the Gold Coast, you tell me how many affordable hotels are on the Gold Coast, right? Like it's monopolized, right? I used to be in that business. It's mainly service-based apartments. It's either service-based apartments or $1,000 a night at the Mondrian or the Langham. You tell me where there's a Best Western. You tell me where there's a Holiday Inn. You tell me, right, again, it is just, it's restricted. Why?
Market concentration.
Yeah, but try and buy a block of land and build a Holiday Inn and make it work. Like what you said before, it's all added into the price.
Mm.
Cost of minimum wage goes up. That's fine. Well, guess what? The loaf of bread goes up,
but
the milk goes up, or you know, the piece of clothing is going to go
but
up.
Why,
or compliance.
But why if you put the minimum wage up, can a loaf of bread or the cost of milk go up? Why is there not a countervailing market pressure on not putting the cost of bread up? What would a countervailing market pressure be? And that countervailing market pressure would be, if I put the price of bread up, the customers will go next door.
Yeah.
But there is no next door.
Yeah, so I agree with you on
But the problem
on the competition.
The problem goes beyond all of this, right? In my eyes, the problem was that we had zero interest rates for so bloody long that if it's free to borrow money, then of course the biggest and best corporations in the world are going to have an advantage and be able to squash their competition.
Yeah, and of course people who have a little bit of money and a little bit of equity can start buying up property. And once I'm a property investor and I'm building a property portfolio, and once the secret is you've got to get one. Correct. Once you've got one, you get two, and then you get four, and then you get six.
But you need to get educated, right? You need to understand, like you're getting educated somewhere. You're listening to something. You're buying. Wherever you're buying it because you've got conviction, because you're being told or it's being, right, you're seeing it. The thing is, the majority of people, right, aren't educating themselves. They're not getting an understanding. We're all good at whinging. We're all good at getting the COVID payments, right, and then buying the brand new fucking 80-inch TV and the brand new Sea-Doo and these types of things. This is the problem.
I'm sure that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
I'm sure that is
not,
part
it's
of
not
the problem.
All of the problem.
But even if you got educated, you still cannot avail yourself of a competitive supermarket industry. You cannot avail yourself of a competitive banking industry. You cannot avail yourself of a competitive airline industry.
Yeah.
We have a growth in market concentration in this country, which is killing capitalism.
It's true, right? Like I'm an entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur since I was 18 with short stints selling land where I felt like an entrepreneur anyway because I was on commission. And what have I been saying to you guys? I wouldn't start a fucking new business. I'm 40 years old. I've got business experience of 20 years and I wouldn't start a new business in the current climate because it's getting harder and harder. And then now with AI coming out, it's going to be even more difficult. And then you've got the government who's basically saying we're going to abolish, we're putting it on the table to look at closing the loophole of distributing profits to beneficiaries and making it a minimum of 30%. Well, it's getting harder and harder for me. The incentives of every day vanishing more and more for me to put myself out there and try and take a risk.
You know what's
happening? Why would I do it? I just buy Bitcoin.
We're going to start losing.
Starts doing.
And we're going to start losing more people. Like I read an article. I think it's like, I forget how many, but it's a lot in the UK. Many, 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 what they call millionaires. Whatever a millionaire is today, I don't even know what a millionaire means anymore. But leaving in droves, right? Mm. Now, most of those millionaires that are leaving in droves, right, are not going to be the employee. Not many of them are, right? You're not going to become a millionaire earning $100,000 a year, right? And trying to live. In my opinion, those are the people that probably most of them are entrepreneurial or small business owners or medium enterprise and just having a gut full of what's happening there. Same thing is like, I knew nobody within the last, you know, say from 3 years ago, 4 years ago, prior to that, I've been here 18 years. So call it 14 years. I didn't know anybody that left this country in my circle of acquaintances and friends in business and in friendships that left the country.
For
tax purposes, for feeling like they're getting screwed. Now, the people that are leaving the country, right, are entrepreneurs. They are business owners that used to employ a lot of people that are now not here, that are now overseas, right? And we're not just, for people listening, it's not just Adam. I know a lot of other friends that have already left. Where are they? They're in places like Dubai is an example, right? And I talked to my mate the other day. He's like, I already got 80 staff. That 80 staff he would have here that is no longer here.
Okay. But if they're leaving because of the tax burden,
yeah,
they're leaving because of a tax burden that is not being equally shared.
I definitely understand that. And that's why I want you go, James.
Yeah, sorry, to say not only that, the employees, but you've got like an intelligence flight. The smarter people are leaving.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I mean,
right?
who's replacing that void?
The incentive, like Mark said, for someone to go out and start business or do something a little bit different. And this is what we're saying. That's why you asked, why is it called unemployable? And we explained it to you, then you kind of understood. But that's what we're trying to teach. But at the same time, it's getting more and more and more difficult, right? And what you're saying is it's not distributed equally. Well, I want to go back to a post that I seen on Instagram when I was doing some research on you when you were booked to come on the pod. And it started off as, I am mad as hell. And you're fuming. You're quite pissed off.
I fume a lot.
And this is quotes, right? This is what you said on, right? The Treasurer has been talking about reforming Australia's tax policies, and the head of productivity commissioner has come out and said that we should be looking at reforming the GST and potentially increasing it. And you were saying how stupid that is and how it doesn't affect the rich, it doesn't affect the poor, it doesn't affect the work, it affects
everybody
in the exact same way, whether you're a retiree, whether you're not. And you're saying in that as well that one third of the major corporations in this country don't pay tax. So basically, I mean, when you read in between the lines, is what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but is what you're saying, corporations, the big corporates aren't paying enough tax. So if we're not getting that fair share, we got to get it from somewhere else.
Yep.
And what's happening is they're coming for
the small guy.
The small guy.
Before I go into that,
they're coming for whatever they can come for and still maintain their political seats.
Yeah,
not get voted out.
Yeah, there's just one part of the record I want to correct. You talk about entrepreneurs leaving, and you talk about that in a pejorative sense that it's bad and that you're getting a flight of ingenuity and creativity. And you're talking about the people who employ versus the people who are employed. I get that, but these are my views, nobody else's, and I'm just saying that, but I want to draw a very clear line. The people who are employed, they also count. They also count to me.
100%.
And the fact that they are not the employers, I still think they've got to get a fair shake.
I agree.
And the fact that they don't have the creativity to create a business, they may still be very productive members of society doing a damn good day's work.
I
will fight for them.
I agree 110%. I agree. And we employ hundreds of people in our businesses, and we will continue to employ hundreds of people in our businesses and hopefully even more in the future.
So now let me get on to the GST.
Okay, yeah. But I want to come back to that one more time because I have one word that I want to talk about and I have it written down here, and I want to, the word I have it circled is productivity, and that's what we'll come back to.
Okay. So the Albanese government won a landslide victory. And because of the way politics works in this country, you can burn through political capital if you've got a massive majority, and you can affect major structural changes, knowing you're going to lose seats as a result at the next election, but you'll still be government again. So that's that. When you have a very big majority, that creates a longer term horizon in your thinking. And so the Treasury is now talking about tax reform, and we need tax reform in this country. There's no doubt about the fact that we need tax reform, because the people who work for the lowest wages have the least flexibility in the amount of tax that they pay, whereas the people who are earning the most have the greatest amount of flexibility. They can afford to buy the best tax consultants. And if the best tax consultants can't give them advice on how to minimize their tax, then they'll go to PricewaterhouseCoopers, and PricewaterhouseCoopers will tell them how to evade tax, because that's how they make their money. So we've got a third of major corporations in this country that are paying no tax. As a result, driving around Sydney, driving on Sydney's roads, it's like driving through the third world, right? P.J. O'Rourke, famous American satirist, I don't know if you know his work, wrote a book called Holidays in Hell. He said, what in the first world constitutes a road hazard, in the third world constitutes the road. Well, in Sydney, that's what the roads are looking like, right? There's potholes everywhere. We've got major forms of public service that are not working properly, whether it be the rail network that keeps breaking down, or the bus network that keeps breaking down, or the hospitals that are not providing adequate care because people, major corporations, are not paying their tax. So the government is going, okay, well, we've got to bring the taxes in. So let's find a way to squeeze the average Joe a little bit harder. And how do we squeeze the average Joe a little bit harder? By increasing GST. And the great thing about GST is you never really see it, because it's included in the final price, right? When I grew up in South Africa, we had GST, and it was always added after the sale.
Same in Canada.
Yeah, right.
You see it. It's a line item on your receipt.
Yep. So it always used to piss us off because we could see it. When you include it in the price, you can sneak it through, right? So the head of the Productivity Commission, instead of saying, we need to reform our taxes so that major corporations that come to this country and earn billions of dollars in revenue, and let me just explain how they earn those billions of dollars in revenue. They drive to their offices using roads paid for by the taxpayer. When they get to their offices, they turn on lights using an electricity grid paid for by the taxpayer. They are kept safe in their beds at night by a police force paid for by the taxpayer. When their workers get sick, they send them to a hospital paid for by the taxpayer. If they have a dispute with a supplier, they litigate that in a court paid for by the taxpayer. They sell their shit using an NBN network paid for by the taxpayer, right? So everything that they do in order to make money is leveraged off assets and facilities that are paid for by the taxpayer, but in return for which they pay no tax, or virtually no tax, very little tax. I think Google, off billions of dollars in revenue, I can't remember what the exact figure was, billions of dollars in revenue, I think they paid $4 million in tax. Like, they're paying something like 2%. And why are they paying 2%? Because they've set their head office up on a sandbar in the middle of the Caribbean, which is now their head office, and which charges them no tax. And they can say to the Australian tax office, well, all our revenue under a tax treaty, we export to the sandbar, and under the tax treaty, we undertake to pay tax in that jurisdiction, knowing full well we'll pay no tax there, right? So we don't pay tax in Australia. So they leverage off all of these facilities paid for by the taxpayer: roads, lights to power their offices, an NBN network, hospitals, schools, police force, judicial system, and in return for which they don't maintain any of that stuff. So where's the maintenance coming from? And the easiest way to do it, squeeze the little guy.
I just looked up some figures, so you can tell me if you think that these are way off or close to the mark. But basically, of all, and this was wild, I didn't think it would be so low, but of all of Australia's tax receipts, corporate tax makes up only about 20%.
Wow.
And yeah, right. I didn't think it was that low. I thought it would have been higher. And with relation to income tax, the richest 10% pay about 55% of all income tax. Is that right? Those two figures would be about right.
I don't know about the second one, about the richest paying 55%, because my understanding
The top 10% pay, I think, somewhere between 52
more
and
than 50, half of the tax.
52 and 4. Yeah. The top 10% pay more than half of the income tax. So the top 10% income earners pay at least 50% of income tax. And then as a percentage of total tax receipts, corporate tax only makes up 19.9%. Mm.
I can certainly believe the first one. I'm not sure about the second one, because there may very well be 10% who are paying 50% of income tax, but I think that there's a band above them who are paying nothing. And the reason why they're paying nothing is because they're not billing any income. They're billing it all as a loan. Do you know how
corporate? Yeah.
Do you know how? Yeah. Do you know why Elon Musk pays no tax?
Mounts up his stock and takes it tax free.
Yeah. Elon Musk doesn't get paid a salary. It's all loans that he never has to repay. Mm-hmm. So he pays no tax. So you might get 10% earners paying 50% of income tax, but there's a band above them, the unseen band above them, that is billing no income and is taking it all as loans that they'll never have to repay and paying no tax. Mm.
You're starting to get me. You're starting to get me on the non-corporate side. I'm starting to distinguish, and the comments are making me do this, making me think hard about it.
Well, this is
what I'm starting to distinguish between us entrepreneurs and corporates.
Everyone,
there's a huge difference, and I think that I've just like naturally sided with, it's not corporate profits, it's not corporate greed, because I know that debt comes first. Sure, there's corporate greed. The government can be like the arsonist and the firefighter, right? Like they put the debt into the system, and then the corporates then go and take advantage and do it better than anyone else.
But it's like when you think of this system, right? You think the majority of people, right, in Australia that have superannuation, that work for an employer that now is going to pay 12%, right, from July 1st, from what I've been told, into the superannuation. Majority of those people will look at their superannuation statement once a year or so, right? Look at it and not know exactly where it's invested in. And the reality is this. We will all sit there and whinge and go, what do you mean I just earned 5% this year on my super, or 4% or 6%? And that's not good enough. A majority of those funds are invested in Google and this and that and this and that. So the game is, if these corporates aren't making the money, right? In a way, it's contradictory.
Can I correct you there?
Yep.
That is an argument that gets put out by these corporates all the time. Leave us alone. Yes, we don't pay a lot of tax, but if we pay more tax, we'll be less profitable, and that'll be reflected in your super. Let me take a run up to say bullshit.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. The amount of money that you are earning in your super from the profits from those companies. So I know what my super is invested in. Google, Facebook, all that stuff, very small percentage. Most of the stuff that my super is invested in is Australian corporations. Those Australian corporations are returning much lower profits because we have the most profitable banks in the world. Where are the banks getting their profit? From corporate profits and from individuals. So if we had more competition in our banking industry which only likes to lend money for mortgages, they don't like to lend money to businesses. We have a real problem financing businesses in this country. Mm-hmm. Banks just pump money into mortgages, right? Yeah. So the little bit of money that banks are willing to put into business finance, they're charging such high interest rates that they have sucked up all the productivity gains that our industry has achieved in the last 15 years. That's why the Productivity Commission says there have been no real wage increases in the last 15 years, because all of those productivity gains have been sucked up by the banks. Why have they been sucked up by the banks? We don't have enough competition in the banking industry. Why don't we have enough competition in the banking industry? Because our politicians are so shit scared of the Australian Bankers Association, because the Australian Bankers Association dishes out the biggest party political donations in the country. Right? And because our banks have the sweet deal with APRA set up so that their internal rating-based model means that our big four banks have cheaper finance than any of their competitors. So the amount of money that we are making in those few companies that pay very little tax and the amount of money that we are making from super profitable banks is more than offset by the amount of money we are not making in big businesses that would return more profit or medium-sized businesses that we could be invested in that would return more profit if they were in a more financially competitive environment.
Understand, and that makes sense. Now, we're going to wrap up here shortly, but what I've got from this conversation, obviously, is Australia needs more competition. In your opinion, Australia needs a lot more competition.
A lot.
In all industries.
Yep.
If it continues the way that it's going, and I don't think it's going to change. I think the you know, we've created the monster that it is. The genie's out of the bottle. And I'm a realist, and I appreciate people like you and, you know, the amount of time and effort and conviction you have towards these topics and the work that you're doing. But a minority is a minority for a reason, and a majority is a majority for a reason. And I don't think it's going to change. I think it's going to continue. I think it's just going to be continue to be monopolized. I think Australia is a small country. There's not many, like if you're, you know, if we're not organically growing the entrepreneurial spirit, the inventors, right? There's no incentive at the moment, I don't think.
But you can grow them and they'll be taxed to death.
Right. This is, where's the incentive for that? What's the incentive for external, you know, corporates to come to Australia? I'm certain industries it is happening, but the reality is it's such a tiny market compared to Europe, compared to the US. And that is why my belief is it will continue
to go downhill,
and there will be more of the haves and the have-nots. I really don't want to be a negative.
That
comes back to the question when you said there's a lot more pain to be had. This is what you're saying.
I think there will be more pain to be had, but again, voices like yours, you know, there aren't a lot.
Okay, right? Can I come back at you?
Yeah.
I will never accept defeat.
Yep.
Okay, I will never ever accept defeat.
Okay. So we've had other senators and whatnot come on and have these amazing arguments. But the reality is if you do not get to a position of power, you can't impact change other than maybe what you're doing on a podcast or whatnot. So if it takes the next 20 to 25 years for someone of your voice or whatever it is to get in power and to be able to affect the kind of change that you're trying to do. And I respect the fact that you will not accept defeat and you'll keep going. And that's very admirable. You've seen Pauline, lover or hater, just keeps going, whether you agree with the politics or not. But what is your advice based on the fact that you know how rigged the system is? What is your advice for the everyday Australian until that point where you get to power?
Okay, there are a number of points that have been made here and I want to address every single one of them. Number one, Margaret Mead once said, never underestimate the ability of a small group of people to change the world because indeed it's the only thing that ever has. Number one. Number two, I don't just affect change by being on podcasts. I affect change. I am in the media offering comment on these issues every single week, sometimes multiple times every week, in the biggest and the most influential newspapers in this country. And I'm battling.
That nobody trusts anymore.
The business community trusts it. Politicians trust it.
The people that you've been bagging for the last hour and a half.
There are enough people who read the things that I say, who read the things that I say when I submit them to Parliament, that it is moving the dial. Has it moved the dial enough? No. But do I affect change only by being on a podcast? No ways.
I'm not saying that's the only way. I don't think that's
your only platform.
But I think what Mark is trying to say.
And as for your remarks about this being a small economy, Singapore's a small economy, much smaller economy. And it is going gangbusters, but it is super competitive. And it has a super high level of regulatory enforcement in the right places. Crooks and scoundrels in the financial industry get hammered, and they get hammered quickly and they get hammered hard, so that they're not stealing people's superannuation like AMP continues to do. And they're not allowing tax cheats like PwC, like we continue to do. And I can tell you, I will run again in 2028. And if I get into parliament, watch out.
Yeah, I take my hat off to you, because there's not a lot of people, right, that would do what you do, right? Like, and have, we all have beliefs, but a lot of us have beliefs with a muzzle and sit there on the sidelines, right? Like, you're in the game, you're putting your head on the chopping block, you're going up against these corporates, you're speaking up against them. And you know, like you said, it's admirable, you take it, whichever angle you're on, whichever side you're on. Majority of us have an opinion that is never spoken about because we're scared shitless. And that's why we've got the podcast, and, you know, we bring different people on so they can, have their own opinion.
Scared shitless, but also unless you're in the position over here, knowing that your voice isn't going to make fuck all difference anyway.
I've voted Liberal all my life, and this year, this election, I voted for an independent, right? So I hope that people like yourself continue to rise to prominence. I honestly do, but I still think, I still would like to hear your answer to the question of what should the average Australian do until then.
I'll give you practical advice. Number one, vote independent. A vote for Liberal or Labor is a vote for two cheeks to the same ass. Right? They are no different. These guys are just two sides to the same coin. They're both just gorging themselves on the public good. And when they get into caucus, they're too shit scared to go up against their donors. Vote for anyone except a major. The majors are dying. The Labor Party got a landslide election win a couple of months ago and had fewer primary votes than they've had in 30 years. They are dying. We've got these bastards on the ropes.
30% of the population? Is it 30% of the vote? Is that it?
I think less than.
Less.
These guys are dying. We've got them on the ropes. And I can tell you another election, or maybe two election, and even with the preference system, we can have these guys out of office permanently. There is a growth in the independents, and the independents cannot be controlled by the Murdoch media.
Do you think that the independents might be cannibalizing each other? That there's so many that it's splitting the vote? That's one thing that I noticed, because we had a few on the show, and I'm like, fuck, like, we need a few of the best of these independents to come together. Because you got like Clive Palmer trying to say this, and you got Paul.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean?
Look, Clive Palmer and the trumpet of...
Whatever, right? All of them.
Fuckwits. I mean, you know, Jesus, the people they had standing for the Palmer party, the one guy's got a rape kill kit in the boot of his car, and he's been on assault charges. Another guy's a unrehabilitated bankrupt. Another one's a fake psychologist who's been banned from ever providing psychology. I mean, where does he get, what sewer does he dredge these people out of? But there are good independents. Renick is good. The Citizens Party, get me elected to Parliament, and I can tell you, I will have the regulators, I will have the Reserve Bank, I will have APRA, I will have ASIC, I will have them weeping. Because I've got the research skills and I've got the background and I know exactly where to put the questions. So there's that. Do not give up on the Australian way. Do not give up on being kind to one another. Do not give up on taking a good-humoured approach. Do not give in to anger. Do not give in to the constant invitations to tear each other apart. Do not become like America.
Let's not let the little guys turn on each other, right?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Misguided anger.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you've got to start looking around. Don't read the Herald Sun. Don't read the Daily Telegraph. They are just fucking trash. You've got to start looking around and starting to see how the big corporates in this country are buying off our politicians, and you need to start contacting your politicians. You need to start contacting them on a regular basis to say, I'm sick and tired of the way you bend the knee to big corporates and to big consulting firms, and you're never going to get my vote if you carry on doing this. And if they get those messages day in and day out, it will start to change their minds.
Well, it's 4 years ago, and with your certainly forwardness.
3 years ago.
Well, not to start polling. You're 3 years, that's right. I hope you make it there, because you're putting one massive fucking bulldog on your back.
Thank you.
No, honestly, your passion and your conviction. Yeah, again, like I said, I take we all.
That's great.
Take our hat off to you. And it's good to hear different perspectives, right?
Like, well, thank you for having me.
You can see that. So it was, great to have you on. Thank you for coming, obviously, here from Sydney to be on here. And for those that are listening, every so often we throw these spanners in the works of these political pods, and they literally go bananas, as you can imagine. The comments on something like this pod will really, really go off. Just want to say thanks again, James, Mark, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
We recorded this one a little bit later than usual because of Andy's schedule flying here. And appreciate you, and thank you for coming on. And if you like what you're watching, if you like what you're hearing, don't forget to subscribe, like, share, comment. Let us know what you enjoy. Let us know what you agree with, what you disagree with.
Tell us you think we're idiots.
And that's all right too, right? Like, this is, we're just trying to bring people on here with different opinions, and then you guys can take that and do what you want with. But at the end of the day, I agree with Andy. Don't stop fighting. Be nice to each other. Lend a helping hand. And let's try and keep Australian.
I thought you were about to say great again.
I was almost going to, and I stopped. Anyways, guys, that's a wrap, and we'll see you on the next one.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.